lost and alone on some forgotten highway, traveled by many, remembered by few, looking for something that I can believe in, looking for something that I'd like to do with my life. There's nothing behind me and nothing that ties me to something that might have been true yesterday. Tomorrow is open. Right now it seems to be more than enough to just be here today. And I don't know what the future is holding in store. I don't know where I'm going. I'm not sure where I've been. There's a spirit that guides me, a light that shines for me. My life is worth living, I don't need to see the end. Sweet, sweet surrender.
Welcome to Freebie Friday. This is a free edition of Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine, delighted to have you with me today. That song you heard bringing us in is called Sweet Surrender by my old buddy John Denver. A little bit of the song just to get a feel for it. And this is one of those episodes that I would call bittersweet. The bitter part of it is that today marks the 21st anniversary that John Denver's plane went down in Monterey Bay, and for his family and friends, it's a day that changed a lot of people's lives in a lot of ways, and that's the bitter part of it. The sweet part of it is, as Tom Crum, his good friend, used to say, and still says probably, so very sad that John is gone, so very glad that he was here. And that's the good part of all this, that he left a legacy and a voice for the planet that I don't think has been matched by anybody since he's been gone. And so much of his work had influence in my life. I've told this story a lot of times on the air and in the podcast, and I've written it in a couple books. And I don't mean to beat it into the ground, but when someone comes along and sees something in you that you can't see in yourself, and you have a pivot point, a palatable shift in the direction of your life, that's something that tends not to be forgotten. And that's exactly what happened for me with John. The interesting part of this is, and I think about this quite often, not just with him, but a lot of people who've shown up in my life, and a lot of the opportunities that I've had to, quote, do this work that I get a chance to do that was not part of my original plan growing up as a kid. I just wanted to play football and coach. That was the extent of my consciousness, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. I think, however, sometimes when you hold a deep longing to something that you know there's more to life than what you have been shown, somehow the universe puts connected dots together over a period of time in a subtle way to nudge us in a certain direction if we're aware of it, even sometimes even if we're not aware of it. The first time I heard a John Denver song, my friend Michelle and I were working at Dunkin' Donuts at Six Corners in Chicago. It was my real first paying job, and I think I made $1.63 an hour or something. This was around 1973 or 74, and one time at work, she said, why don't you come over afterwards? We live not too far away from each other. Why don't you come over afterwards? You got to hear this guy's voice. I think you're really going to like it. Okay. And so I walked over to her house after, it was a warm summer night. I'll never forget some of the pieces of this. Just a gorgeous summer evening. And she lived in kind of like a brownstone, a two-story brownstone. And there she was in, on the porch, and she had the speakers of the hi-fi stereo in the window, and she dropped the needle on an album John had done called Back Home Again. And I believe in, you know, I'd heard a couple of his songs earlier on the radio. Take Me Home Country Roads came out in 71. And of course, Rocky Mountain High had already been out, which is an anthem in its own right. But there was something about that song, Sweet Surrender, on that album at that time, in that moment, on that summer night, that this, I can't explain it. It kind of clicked something over, like a switch flipped inside me. And this song went right through me. It was his voice for sure, but I think it was the message that it brought with it, that we're all kind of lost and alone on a forgotten highway, traveled by many, remembered by few, looking for something that I can believe in, looking for something that I'd like to do with my life. And as a 14-year-old kid, whatever I was at that time, that just became stamped on my soul. So that led to, you know, listening to more songs and all the rest of it. And back then, it wasn't real cool to listen to John Denver. Kiss was out and hard rock and all that kind of stuff. And so here I was, this rough, tough football playing guy on one hand, and then I'd go home or hanging out with my buddies and I'd throw the cassette of, you know, Calypso in or Annie's song or something. And they looked at me like I had, you know, a butthole in the middle of my forehead sometimes. I think they were reluctant fans as well, though. So it all turned out. But the odd and interesting thing is, years later, I would never have guessed that in 1992, I believe it was, I was watching The Tonight Show. Jay Leno was the host by then, and John was his first guest. And he mentioned that he was singing at the Wang Center in Boston on December 3rd of that year. So this is probably a month earlier. And it was like something else went off. And I'm like, I have to be there. And I'd already met John at a fundraiser in Colorado a few years earlier. And when I was in the Coast Guard and out in Colorado, my aunt lived there. And I had attended a couple of the symposiums that he had done in Snowmass, Colorado for the Windstar Foundation that he and Tom Crum created. It was like a think tank of sustainability. And people would come off from all over the world. So I was kind of versed in it, swimming in a little bit. But something else was going on. Long story short, I bought a ticket, not knowing why, flew to Boston for December 3rd, was able to connect with Chris O'Connor, who's just a great human being, and told him, I'm supposed to talk to John. I'm not even sure why. He said, okay, fine. You can talk before the concert. And they were running late. There was a snowstorm in Boston. And John, who knew me a little bit at that point, walked in and he's like, what are you doing here? This isn't Chicago. I'm like, no kidding. And he had a kind of a puzzled look on his face. And Chris came up and said, you know what? We lost our window to connect. So I can't do anything, but I can give you some cheeseburgers and you can wait downstairs while we're tuning up the guitars or whatever and getting ready for the show. So I went down to the underneath the theater stage in the Wang Center in Boston. I'm chewing on some cheeseburgers that Chris had given me. I'm listening to the music upstairs. And that nudge comes again. It's like, we got to talk. And again, I still really didn't even know why. So I walked up on one of the wings of the stage. They're performing, I mean, bold as hell. I don't know what I was thinking. I probably wasn't, which was better. And Chris comes over and says, what are you doing on stage, man? I mean, you can't be up here. And I'm like, listen, where are you guys at tomorrow night? And I think they were headed to Pittsburgh. And I said, well, I'll meet you there. And he's like, look, okay, 15 minutes after the show, like to get rid of me. But, you know, this stuff goes on a little bit. And while I was a fan of John's musically, I just felt like there was something else going on that I needed to connect with. And so it was a great concert he did for the Catholic Charities of Boston, raised like $250,000 for homeless people and what have you in Boston. It was a great thing. It was in great voice. It was astonishing what the man could do with his voice in concert. And so afterwards, I go downstairs and everybody had cleared out. And I walk in and John walks in. He gives me a hug. He's like, what are you doing here? And I said, I thought you'd know. Now, there's a brilliant answer. And he kind of just looked at me and he said, did you bring me anything? And it was so odd because I've recounted that moment frozen in time in my mind many times. And I didn't even realize that I had some letters in my jacket pocket that I'd stuck there probably 2 months, 3 months earlier from a school that I had spoken to about some environmental things. I was not a published author. I wasn't a radio person. I wasn't on the radar at all, except to being moving in a direction that life was calling me. And I said, oh, yeah, maybe these letters. And I gave him these letters. And they were from kids that had written to me about what I had said about environmental responsibility and that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, like there was this shift, and he gets this big grin on his face. And I kept thinking to myself, like, when John smiles, not for the cameras, but like it just comes on him, it was like a kid that got out of school early, and he just this creeping grin across his face. And he looks up at me and he says, "We have to do something about this." And I didn't even know what the hell he was talking about. And he puts his hand on my shoulder and he looks at me in the eye and he said, "John, do you understand that your voice matters? Do you get that?" No one had ever asked me that question in my life up to that point. So of course I didn't understand that. I looked at him and I shook my head. No, I don't get that. And he said, "Your voice matters in the way things go, both great and small. The coming years will prove me correct. I know this to be true about you, and you're going to find your voice, and it will find you." And it was this moment that's just like locked in my brain. And he says, "Do me a favor, put these letters in my bag. It's in the room over there, and then let's stay in touch, and I got to go to this other thing and this and that." And sure. I'm like, I don't even know what's going on, but sure. And I gave him a hug and we promised to stay in touch and I put the stuff in the bag and that was it. I feel vindicated, did the right thing, flew there on a hunch, no idea why. And I get back to Chicago and that was it. And maybe 6 months later, I get a phone call from the Windstar Foundation and it was a woman who was very nice and she said, "Mr. Denver brought those letters that you gave him in Boston to the board meeting and we're all trying to figure out how do we implement some sort of school programming for with Windstar, how we reach the students, because they're really the ones that are going to make the biggest difference." And I thought, oh my God, that's fantastic. And if I could be a part of that somehow, some small way, or moving that along in the right direction, it was worth the price of a plane ticket and staying in a really seedy motel right next to the ocean in Boston, but having some great crab legs. So it kind of balanced itself out. But it wasn't done yet. What I unwillingly, unknowingly, maybe willingly, but certainly unknowingly, things had been set in motion. And 2 years later, in 1994, I woke up one morning and I was just overwhelmed with the fact that I think I'm supposed to be at this Windstar Foundation thing. And I was teaching school at the time, and I got to school one day at Schurz High School, and there was a flyer in my mailbox, and it says coming up in that August, late August, September of 94 was Choices for the Future of the Human Family. And that was the theme of the Windstar event that year. And as I mentioned, 2,000-3,000 people would show up, and you know, Jacques Cousteau and Ted Turner and all these luminaries, these visionaries, these leaders would get up and talk and encourage people to go out and be the change you want to see in the world. And John would sing, and it was quite a big deal in the mountains. And I got that flyer, and all of a sudden these words started coming to me, and I could not stop it. So I taught all day. I covered a bunch of classes. But when I would sit there, I would start jotting things down. These little words would come in bits and pieces. Very different for me. Hadn't written a book. Hadn't done anything I'm quote unquote known for you today. I got home that afternoon, sat in the yard. It was a nice warm day. And wrote the words to something called The Human Family. It literally spilled out of me. I sat in a lawn chair, watched the kids play in the yard, and I wrote The Human Family. That put more things in motion. By the end of that summer, I was absolutely convinced I was supposed to be on stage at Windstar with no credentials, really. And yet, it wasn't happening. I was like spiritually constipated. I just could not shake this feeling I'm supposed to be there, and yet I couldn't do anything about getting there. I was not of name and note. And even though there was these flecks in the pan, these people I met, and all this other stuff was going on, and this one constant was a friend of mine, still a friend of mine today, Ginny Weissman, who I met years ago in Chicago, and she was the witness to all this, and a couple other people, but I would call Ginny more than anybody else, say, "I can't even believe this is going on," and it was just this enormous pressure. So one day, 2 weeks before the event, we were going to drive out to Colorado, as we had a few times before, load the truck up, take everybody go out there, and 2 weeks before the event, I'm down in the basement, never forget it, cleaning the cat box. And the phone rings upstairs, and I don't know if we had voice. There might have been voicemail or something like that, an answering machine. But it was one of those rings. I thought, I think I'm supposed to answer this. Like, it's important to answer this. So I dropped the little scooper with the cat shit. And I ran upstairs and I answered the phone. And it was a woman calling from John Denver's office in Colorado, or from Aspen. And she said, we had a cancellation from Dr. Mae Jemison, who is the first female black astronaut in history and was slated to speak at the Windstar Foundation this year in just a couple weeks. And she had to cancel. And John said to call you. I was going to be a smartass and say, let me check my calendar. I may have even said that, but of course, I was overwhelmed with what? 2 weeks? You want me to talk where? I had never done anything on a platform, on a stage, attended by people from around the world at that point, ever. And then I went right back to that human family thing I'd written months earlier. And I thought, something's going on here. So we ended up flying out the royal treatment to Aspen. And I remember the night before at the hotel, there's a beautiful hotel at the far end of town in Aspen. And they had this whirlpool there, this huge whirlpool, hot tub. And I'm sitting in there sweating for a lot of reasons, thinking, John Denver invited me to speak at this event. And I don't have any notes. I don't know really what I'm going to talk about, except I'm supposed to talk. And I remember looking, sitting there sweating 9-10 o'clock at night, and I'm looking out to the mountains and thinking, how in the world did this all come together? A kid from Chicago who years ago, 22 years earlier, listened to a song that a friend said I should listen to, or an album, and then I hear this Sweet Surrender, and here I am getting ready to do this. And it was just, I didn't even know what the words are for all that. Thankful, blessed, you could, whatever the deal is, but I still had to do the talk. And the next morning, it was a gorgeous Saturday in Aspen, and without any notes, I was able to be part of something I thought was very important, which had nothing to do to some degree with John Denver's music or anything like that, but it really had to do with more who the man was, and I think in so many ways is, because he lives on through so many people that continue to do the work that he put in motion. And so, as I said earlier, it's 21 years ago today that he died in that plane crash. Since that time, bandmates and fans would start gathering in Aspen and remembering him. And so Annie Denver put that in place and made the suggestion to the bandmates, and they did a little impromptu concert the first year. And then it's grown ever since, every year. Now thousands of people converge all these years later on Aspen to sing his songs and tell stories and hang out and do whatever they do. And how we die, of course, is not nearly important as how we live. And John sure lived. He took his talents to the utmost. He ran while most of us walk, and he flew while most of us kind of just glide. And I've always appreciated that about him. His music has now become almost like third on the list when I think of him. It's more about the intent that he had and the things that he accomplished in a very short amount of time. He was only 53 when he died. So as I get ready to turn 60, and I kind of bemoan my fate sometimes that I don't have the public platform that I used to have to talk about things I think are important and not get, you know, diluted off into, we've learned to major and minor things in this country, and it's not helping anybody. And I've always taken some measure of pride in the work that I do. And the reason I even have the opportunity to do most of these things was because after that talk in Aspen, my life went in a 180 degree direction. And all that followed became writing books and more speaking, and then radio. Never would have guessed any of that would have happened. But it all comes out of, in my opinion, the connection I had with that night and the conversation with John when he asked me the question, do you know your voice matters? If I didn't know it, I couldn't do this. And I think a lot of people aren't real clear that their voice matters, or they're using it for things that are just arguing is not progress. So what I did every year since John passed, whether it was on the radio in Michigan or Chicago, I would do something to remember this man who had not just such an impact on my life, but the lives of millions of people around the world, still does to this day. Back in 2007, when I was at Oprah Radio, I put on and produced and host with a whole team of producers, I should say, and I hosted something called John Denver, The Man and His Music. It turned out to be a three-hour special, 2.5 hours of interviews and memories and moments with people like Annie Denver and Milt Okun, John's producer, and Hal Thaw, who worked with him for years in the business side of things, and Tom Crum, who was his best buddy, and the list goes on and on. And then we added about a half hour of music that was all live, and the thing ended up being nominated for a Peabody Award. I think it didn't win because it was too friggin' long, but people enjoyed it. It got a lot of airplay. So ever since then, I have kind of put that stuff aside to some degree. But today I wanted to pull that out, and it's on the same date, October 12th, 1997, and here we are, October 12th of 2018, 21 years later. I've grabbed some clips from that 07 program that aired on Oprah Radio and on Sirius XM. The first gentleman you're going to hear is a guy named Terry Lipman, who has unfortunately left the building as well a few years ago. He's a brilliant, funny man, and his story about how he met John and the work that he was going to do with him had to be included in this, because I think it speaks to the fact of serendipity as you hear Terry's story, and follow through as you hear how things progress once serendipity takes place. And then my good friend John Barry is after that. He is a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, country music star with the best of them. He's had like a third go-around now. He's got a song out called Beautifully Broken that's just smashing the charts, and he's a Nashville Opry guy, and I catch him on the road now and again, and he's just a fantastic talent. And John's music had a great influence in his life, and it shows up on stage and other places, so I put John's clip in there. And then we get on to Roland Smith, who was a serious news guy for most of his career out in New York, and then he runs into John, and next thing you know, he's hosting the WinStar Choices for This Future Symposium for like 20 years. And nothing like seeing a guy from New York wearing a rawhide vest, you know, with cowboy boots. I love that. And that morning, when I walked out on stage in 1994 to do The Human Family, and Roland Smith introduced me, I knew I had arrived. And then the great, late Roger Nichols, the immortal Roger Nichols, who was one of the top producers in the history of music. He had more gadgets and more gizmos and more inventions than anybody. They're actually doing a documentary on Roger's life. And he and John met, so John could up the quality of his records. And there's a story in that conversation about how John and Roger went to the Soviet Union long before anybody else did. And Roger had built these recording devices that fit in suitcases. And then after that was done, that concert tour was done, you'll hear it in the story, it opened up the doors for cultural exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States. And next thing you know, Billy Joel's going. And that would not have happened without John Denver paving the way. And I don't think a lot of people get that. One of my favorite people on the planet, Roger's wife, Conrad Reeder, Connie, backed up John on stage for the better part of 20 years. What an incredible voice she had. And they just had these great moments and thoughts about John and all that went into that. And then finally, Michael Murphy, who wrote the song Wildfire and is a huge star of Western music, has always been one of my favorite voices. And when we did this back in 2007, we had the track Murph down, and he actually pulled over his bus caravan somewhere in Texas so he could join us and we could record it. And it was such a heartfelt interview with him, a conversation that just had to be the way that I wrapped this thing up. And so you'll hear that as well. On the back end of this, I want to share something else with you. But for now, let's move on to John Denver, the man and his music.
You know, over the years, it wasn't just only in the United States that John Denver was a huge draw. He was very popular all over the world. I mean, the guy sold over 100 million albums worldwide in a 30-year career. But really, for some reason, Australia struck a chord with John. And if I go back to 1989 at the WinStar Choices for the Future Symposium, I recall very clearly that a contingent from Australia came, and they brought all kind of cool things for the Americans. They brought these little clip-on koala bears, of which I still have one that I wear on my jacket every now and again. If I recall correctly, they bought some Foster's Lager, and we stayed up quite late one night hoisting a few. And I ran into a gentleman named Terry Lipman. Terry is an incredible guy. He's a brilliant filmmaker and producer. And even though it's almost been 20 years since I've spent time with them in Aspen and at WinStar, we couldn't really do this special about John's life and about his music without that Australian voice. And my good friend Terry Lipman joins me. G'day, mate.
G'day, John.
I don't have a very good Australian accent, but I'm earnest.
Well, you're doing pretty good, mate.
I don't know the story. I know that you and John met somewhere in Australia. That's all I really know, and the rest, as they say, is history. What happened? How did you two cross paths?
Well, it was a really incredible time in my life, John. I'd been involved. I had an insurance and financial services business and an entertainment business, and I was kind of a workaholic. And one day I got very, very sick, and I had a near-death experience, which I wouldn't recommend, but it certainly changed my life. And when I came out of it, I really didn't know who the dickens I was. And while I was recuperating from that, I started to look at the future. I had no idea what I was planning to do. But one day, one of my friends came to me and had a tape that John Denver had recorded some years ago in the Aspen Institute. And it was called On Being Human. I was very moved by it because I only knew John as a singer. I had no idea, you know, how deep were his convictions. The only thing I was really doing at that time was sailing. So I took this tape down to my boat, and I put the tape in, and suddenly, who should walk down the marina but John Denver? And I just stood there. I was kind of stunned. And, of course, you know, I had to go and tell him the story. And so we met, we talked, and he said, listen, I'm going sailing. When I get back, I'll call you. So I thought to myself, you know, why on earth would John Denver want to call me? The superstar he was in those days. Anyway, sure enough, he called me, and he said, Terry, I tell you what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to get a few of your friends, and I'd like to come and talk to them. And so I said, fine, I'll be happy to do that. I did that, and we sat around in my house on the floor, and John sat on the floor for probably around a couple of hours.
Now, Terry, what year was this?
This was in 1988.
Okay.
It was a year before we met.
Okay.
Anyway, not to make a story too long, as a result of that, that group was so inspired by John, and we created Windstar Australia. So that's how I met John.
You know, it's astounding to me, the things that I hear more and more about how many people John affected, you know, not just through song, but to stop and see someone on the wharf, or to, you know, stop in traffic or whatever. And he made himself available, which is not usually the normal thing that superstars that sell hundreds of millions of albums do. I mean, when that happened for you, and you know, after the near-death thing, and you got to be friends with JD, and the whole Windstar thing took off, I mean, it must have catapulted your life in a whole other direction.
Well, it did. It was like I was, after the NDE, it was like I didn't really know what I was going to do. I sold all my businesses, and I just stayed at this beautiful place in Church Point, and I sailed, and I was probably, you know, seeking something, and then John kind of entered my life at that time, and it started a whole new life for me.
Terry, John was so well received in Australia. I mean, there was a real love affair between the people,
boy.
and you know, at the Sydney Opera House and the specials that he did from Down Under. What was it about? What did the Aussies connect with in John?
There was a certain magic that he had, and it's been very interesting because, at the moment, as you know, I'm working on a documentary.
Yes, and it's and the title is one of a song title.
Yeah, it's called What One Man Can Do. And it's really not about John, but it's about his vision. And it's about how we can all make a difference in the world. As I said, it was almost before his time when he actually talked to us about some of his concerns for the planet.
Yes.
But if you look at the world right now, you know, where we have such separateness. I mean, John was about bringing people together, because the future, really, unless we can all work together, you know, doesn't matter where we come from.
Right.
You know, we're in for trouble.
Yeah. Listen, I hate to breach this every time on these interviews, but where were you when you heard about John?
Boy, you know, that was really interesting for me because we were devastated. And the week before, John and I had been backstage at his concert in Austin, Texas, at the Bass Hall, where he'd done a one-man show, and he was brilliant. And we had a little party afterwards. And he said to me, Terry, he said, I want to make a film. He said, I want to make another film, but I don't want it just to be an ordinary film. I just want it to be a film that really communicates who I am and what I'm concerned about, and I want you to do it for me. And I just looked at him and I said, okay, John. And a week later he died, and I just let the whole conversation die with him.
Yes.
10 years later, I'm making that film.
You know, with just the last few minutes that we have left, I always been asking the folks that we've been spending time with about their favorite songs. And, you know, he put out such a great library of music, you know, I don't know, over 350 some odd songs under his name. And you told me that It's About Time was really your favorite. Why is that?
Well, I think it was probably a friend played it to me, and I was so moved by it, I just freaked out at the time, because it's in the few words of that song, John says it all. And it's just a beautiful, simple song, but the lyrics are so meaningful and so important that I find that song to live on with me and be part of who I am.
Mm. It's a great privilege and a pleasure always spending time with you, my friend. I hope it's not too long before we talk again.
But I don't think a lot of people got, because what the voice that you heard in concert, of course, doesn't always come across on, in those days, vinyl and then CDs. But he had this amazing instrument. And to me, as Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said, the human voice is the organ of the soul. And there's another guy whose voice really reminds me of John's tenor and power. That's, of course, John Barry. He's one of the most distinctive voices in country music. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. Obviously, much like, we're about the same age, you were drawn to John's music when you were a young guy, too, and when he came to the Omni in Atlanta. And that voice thing that I was talking about, can you expand on a little bit?
Well, you know, it's just John had that beautiful way of singing a song, but not in a way, he was singing with you. He wasn't singing at you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if everybody understands quite the difference in that, but it was just, there are singers, and I have to say that I have been, I will accuse myself of being one of those people that in the past where I have sang at you, you know?
Okay.
And other people do that too, and they just, and they sing in such a way that you don't feel, you don't feel comfortable or invited singing along.
So there's not a real connection.
Right. But John had a real gift for singing in such a way that made you want to sing with him. It was a great gift. It was just a real gift of communication.
Do you remember the first concert that you went to where you saw him way back at the Omni?
1975, May of 1975.
When you left that concert, what had changed for you?
That was the very first concert I'd ever been to. And, you know, to be there, and I with 18,000 of John's closest friends and neighbors, and to share that music. It's really funny when I hate to jump ahead, but when I went to see him many years later with my wife,
mm-hmm.
she kept elbowing me in the side going, you do that. That's how you do that.
Uh-huh.
That's where you get that from. And that is, you know, whatever communication type that I have, that's where it came from. And just, you know, seeing, I think that's what when I left there, with this desire to emulate this man and his music.
Mm. You know, one of the CDs that somebody, I think you guys sent me a few years back, was your Songs and Stories CD, and you tell on that album, you guys still call them albums, right?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
you were telling about the time where you, I think, were changing the oil in the tractor, and your wife came out and had a little surprise for you. Can you share that?
Yeah, we lived on a farm north of Athens, Georgia for many years, and I was in my barn changing the oil in my farm tractor, and I heard her call me down from the house, that faint voice through the trees calling, John! And as I laid there with oil dripping on my forehead, I remember thinking to myself, now, she's got 2 feet. But knowing what's good for me, I jumped up and ran to the front of the barn and said, yes, dear. And she said, come here. I think that's actually my middle name, John Come Here Barry. And So I reluctantly went down to the house, and she said, "You need to come in and get ready. We're going to Atlanta. I've got a surprise." I said, "I can't go to Atlanta." I said, "I'm in the middle of something I can't just walk away from." She said, "Mom's watching the kids. Come on, get ready. I got a surprise for you." And I'm not a surprise-oriented person. Some people go, ooh, yeah, surprise. I'm not one of those guys. I'm like, no surprise. And but, of course, knowing what's good for me, once again, I went in and got dressed, and I'm trying to find out where we're going. She's not giving up any information. Mm-hmm. We get in the car to drive the 70 miles to Atlanta, and the worst thing of all, she has to drive. As the commercial says, there are drivers and there are riders. I am a driver. I drive. And but this particular trip I didn't get to. She drove. She knew where we were going. I had no idea. And we get downtown Atlanta. We exit off on North Avenue, and we're crossing over the bridge, and there it is, the Varsity hamburger joint. And I'm mm-hmm. like, I love this woman. She's bringing me all the way to Atlanta to take me to the Varsity. This is love. And she drives right past it. And I'm like, where are you going? She goes, we're not going to the Varsity. I said, why not? I will love you more if we go to the Varsity. And she keeps going. She said, you're a nut. I'm going to keep going. And she turns left on Peachtree Street, and there on the marquee of the Fox Theater, it says, live tonight, sold out, John Denver. And I just decided not to even think that's where we're going for fear she won't turn in. Mm-hmm. And but she does. And I said, so why are we here? She says, I got tickets. I got fourth row center stage tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just dying. Living out in the woods like I did, I didn't even know John was in town.
Okay.
And I was beside myself. And
since 1975 in between then?
I don't think so.
So it's been a long haul.
It had been a long time. That's, you know, and enjoyed his music and seen, you know, television things and different mm-hmm. odds and ends, but never live mm-hmm. since that time. And it was just a spectacular night. We laughed together. We sang together. The ushers came and asked me to sing Quieter Than John. It was great. And then we, after the show, I thanked for my wife for just a spectacular surprise. And she said, that's not all. And I said, what do you mean that's not all? She said, we got backstage passes. So back we went, and I got to meet John, and I was, you know, we were there. I don't know, there were 20 or 30 of us in the meet and greet room, you know, and he met everybody, and Rob and I were last in line, and he said, who are you folks? And I said, I'm John, this is my wife, Robin, and just really enjoyed the show. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but thank you for a great night. And out the door we went. My wife, she smacked me in the arm. She said, why didn't you talk to him? Why didn't you tell him? You just put out a record called, that's when Faces had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
She said, you listed John as your most important musical influence. Why didn't you talk to him? And all I can say is I just didn't know what to tell him. And, you know, it was not too long after that when this tragedy happened, and later that year. And his music meant a great deal to me. And I, you know, so much of what I do performance wise is because of what I learned by listening and watching John Denver. And it is in my show, I still do Annie's Song most nights. And I tell the story about meeting John and the surprise from my wife And I kind of sum the story up because here's a woman who loved me so much, who provided this wonderful opportunity in my life that meant so much to me. And I get to sing this song, and every night I just sing it as best I can. If there was some way that John could sing through me that night, I just sort of make myself available for that to happen. It's just that little moment that I get to say thank you to a man and to his music that has meant so much to me in my career. And it's pretty amazing what he has meant to so many people.
one of the highlights of my life, and really something that put me in a new direction, was the opportunity to speak at John's invite at a Windstar symposium, the Windstar Foundation. And it was really to be a think tank for all things that had to do with developing and creating a sustainable future. I clearly remember a late August morning in Aspen, Colorado, a beautiful sunny day in the Aspen Music Tent, and standing backstage waiting to be introduced to some 1,500 people from around the world for the Windstar Choices for the Future Symposium, The Human Family. And the man whose voice introduced me that day and had introduced many symposiums is one of the most revered and respected journalists in the media. His name is Roland Smith. Over 40 years of professional broadcast experience as an anchor and a reporter, a producer, a commentator. This guy is a widely published author. He's a poet. He's a documentary filmmaker. And as I mentioned, he was the master of ceremonies for many, many Windstar Choices for the Symposiums, and a very good friend of John's, and a pilot himself. And when he called my name that morning, I kind of knew I had arrived, and I get to call his name out this time. And Roland Smith joins me. Hi, Roland.
Hey, John. What a you know, that's the nicest introduction I think I've ever had in my entire life.
It took me 3 weeks. It took me 3 weeks to write that.
I think it was with 94. Was that
1994? You are correct, sir. When I heard your voice and I walked out, we shook hands. I thought, oh, now I got to perform.
Well, as I recall, you did a magnificent job, as you do on a continuous day-to-day basis. But, you know, that was then, and, yep. You know, we've all changed just a little bit. I am just a touch older, and you're probably a lot older.
Roland, how did you and John meet originally? How'd that happen?
I met John a long time ago, probably in the 1980s, when he was a guest on an interview segment for Channel 2 in New York. But I really met him when I was co-hosting the morning program with Mariette Hartley back in 1987. Oh. He was a guest on this nationwide program, and I was doing the interview, and he started to talk about Windstar. And, you know, as all interviewers will do, I said, well, you know, what's Windstar?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, why don't you come out and find out? And I looked over to the producer, the executive producer of the broadcast, Bob Shanks, and Bob said, go. So I said, when are you going to be there? And he says, I'll be there in a couple of days. I said, so will I.
Wow.
And I'll come back and I'll report on what Windstar is all about. That began my association with Windstar and a longtime association with John until his death. And it was truly one of positive power and a spiritual experience.
Do you think that he was before his time?
I think, like all mystics and all prophets, he was here at the right time, and he probably left at the right time, as unfortunate, because truly only his body died. I mean, his spirit is there, not only in his songs, not only in the memories that you have, that I have, and that all the people you've talked to, and everybody who ever listened to every one of his songs still feels it. And that he gave of his spirit as much as he did in the way he did.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I don't find, to me, vibration is very important. I surround myself with people who help me raise up. And I have very little time, the older I get, even though you're much older than I am, by the way, that I have very little time for that which brings me down. I don't see any purpose in it. I don't want to buy into it. I don't want to swim in it. I don't want to have it on me. And so I've only found, and as you know, both of us in a little different ends of the media, but media can be a haven for that stuff. And music can be a haven for that stuff. And I could put on a CD that I could have heard the song 500 times, and the 501st time, Rocky Mountain High means something different to me.
Isn't that the truth? You know, and that's always the truth with truth. The saying of it differs every time. But the perception of it only comes from where you are at the moment of the listening or the moment of the reading.
I've asked a couple questions of everybody, and all the answers are very different. And the first question is, you know, what you had such a, you know, everybody on this show has had a unique position in John's life at one time or another. All these different viewpoints, and you held your own singularly unique viewpoint with John in his life. Is there a certain thing about him that you remember most? Is there an aha thing about John that maybe we should all know about?
The aha thing. I think for me it had to have come at a dinner we were sharing in La Jolla back in the probably 93, probably maybe 94, before he died, in which he talked more about spirit and less about the golf that we were going to play the next day.
Hmm.
And we were sharing a glass of wine, which we had done often, and thoroughly enjoying it. And I don't remember, and I wish I could, the exact way he put it, but I remember the feeling. And the feeling was, I was talking to somebody who had a mystical connection to the all that is. And listening to him talk about values for the world, the universe, the cosmos, listening to him speak with joy about his understanding and connection to all of the species of nature, whether it was dolphins or polar bears or eagles flying. That's basically what I remember. And it wasn't too long after that that he passed. John saw life as never ending. And I agree with that. I mean, we may pass from this form and this density, but we do not die. Only the body dies. The essence of what it is we are lives forever. And I think that's probably why he wrote this song after his father passed. And what I can remember is the refrain, I think, which is, "Why is it thus we are here, and so soon we are gone?"
Mm.
Well, isn't that the truth for all of us?
It
why is.
Is
it thus we are here? You got to ask that question about your being and about yourself. Why are we here? Have we done the things that we promised to do before we even got here?
I agree with that.
John asked that same question to himself on a continuous basis, and that's why he wrote the kinds of songs that he did, and why I would always call him a mystic. And you are doing this because it's needed out there now, and I thank you.
I was telling John Barry, the thing that's starting to run through all these interviews that I'm seeing very clearly is that, is there anything greater than to live your life in such a way that 3,650 days later, people mm-hmm. still feel this way about you?
Well, one time I was moaning about John dying so young, because I think 53 is the older I get. And this person, Ron Lemire, actually said, you know, John really lived about 10 lifetimes in one. And it's true. I mean, he just did so much.
Yeah. So along with Connie Reeder is Roger Nichols. And, of course, Roger's really a legend in the music industry, and of which we're connected to, even though it's talk radio. He's run 7 Grammy Awards. And he's really a guy who has taken technology and really morphed it in such a way to really bring out the best of the human voice. And Roger and Connie join me on this really special tribute to John Denver. Hey, guys.
Hi, John.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. You know, isn't it this fake hello stuff? Isn't it terrible? We've already talked for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I hate that stuff. How fine. Well, how are you?
I have a question. Do you have a tip jar there? Should I send some money up for that, for saying nice things?
You know, Milt Okun said the same thing. I said, I spent all day writing his. You know, actually, no, it's just off the top of my head. But it's true, though. And what I'm finding out as we go along this little John Denver adventure here is that he really drew the best and the brightest to him in so many different ways. And you guys, of course, both standouts in your field. Connie, you were backing John up for almost 20 seasons. And Roger, you produced, you know, more than 3 handfuls of albums with John. I mean, how did you guys all kind of meet together? It's got to be a special story.
Well, who's going first?
Connie. Well, I met him before Connie did by not very many days. But John called me up one day out of the blue and said, you know, would you like to meet me at my bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel? I'd like to talk to you about, working on my albums. And I said, okay, great. So I met him there, and you know, I had never been a big fan of John Denver's songs so much because I didn't listen to them. You know, I was familiar with all of them, and I was more familiar with John's, you know, worldwide, how he's accepted worldwide and mm-hmm. did the stuff with Jacques Cousteau and things like that. And mm-hmm. and so I liked him as a guy, and so I went and met with him, and we spent all day talking about stuff. And then when I left that room, I was one of the biggest John Denver fans, right? And so he wanted me to help improve the sound of his records and stuff, and I said, sure, I'd love to do that. And then Connie met him separately, like 2 weeks or what was it, a month later or something?
I think a week.
A week?
It was only a week.
Did one know the other was connecting with the other? I mean, was it, or was
no?
It really...
I met him in a totally unrelated situation.
Within a week.
Right. And Roger said he, you know, was working with John Denver, and I went, okay. Yeah, we had just had a child, mm-hmm. daughter, and she was keeping me real busy. And she was only 3 months old at that point. And I had actually gone to hear an Indian guru who was touring America at that time. He was in a makeshift hotel with a big tent. And a friend of mine invited me to come hear him speak. And I walked in, and there was John singing What One Man Can Do right in front of this Baba Muktananda. And I thought that was interesting. And then, but then I couldn't stay because the baby started crying, and I was asked to leave. And I was ushered to this office, and so while I was discreetly nursing her, John was ushered into the same room and stood over me with this glow. And I looked up and I said, oh, hi, John. You're working with my husband, Roger, and then that's how we met.
So that's sort of how everything that happened with John went along. I mean, we got to do great things. You know, Connie was with John singing in Australia. And then John called me up and said, hey, why don't you come down here to Australia, you know, after we finish up the concerts. So mm-hmm. I flew down to Australia, and then finally, so 84, 85 was the big thing, which was the, we talked about that before, the Russia concert.
Yes.
So,
Now set this up for folks, because this is talking about the concerts, one thing, but you got to remember, if you go back to 1984 going in 85, the United States and the Soviet Union, it's not like it is now. It was a different world, right?
Right. Completely different. I mean, there was no cultural agreement between the two countries, and it had been, you know, the cultural agreement had gone for like 9 years by now, unsigned between the two. And what it was is, if you think about this, it was just one word. So the cultural agreement says each country will supply security for the other country's artists.
Mm-hmm.
So to us, that means, well, okay, we'll make sure they get guarded and nothing happens to them, and, you know, all that kind of stuff is what we mean by security. The Soviet Union, what they mean by security is no. Security means when we send somebody over to the United States to perform, we want them back. And we had started talking about doing, John wanted to be the first one to go over there and sing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, let's have some. We had some meetings with the State Department, and he got sponsors from 84, which was to go over there. Not public concerts; they were just for the Russian big or the Soviet bigwigs.
Sure.
So there were little concerts for them and their, you know, families and stuff. So there were maybe 300 to 500 people. Mm. We did a concert in Moscow, and then Leningrad, and then Tallinn for these guys, and. They said, well, gee, there's nothing wrong with a John Denver concert, and some of them even knew the songs and stuff, and they said, oh, let's do this. And the more amazing thing is, and so we went back in 85 to do the first public concerts, and so we did 11 shows in those same three cities, and the audiences, even though they couldn't speak English, knew some of the words and were singing along, yeah, just like you're talking. They're clapping and toe-tapping and singing along to these songs, and it was like, you know, just to grab your heartstrings and wouldn't let go.
You know, Billy Joel got a big hit because he did the, you know, the concert from Soviet Union. But do you think that would have been the hit that it was had John not laid that foundation?
Well, it wouldn't have happened. Because John's name is in the cultural agreement. as putting that whole thing together. Mm-hmm. And it was because of that that cultural agreement got signed before Billy Joel went.
You know, Connie, for a long 20 years and a lot of albums and a lot of concerts and a lot of television appearances, you back John up with your voice. And I asked John Barry during this special, who's got a very prolific and very full tenor voice himself, that there seemed to be something about John's voice that was, when you heard it in concert, when you heard it live, it was almost like he was born to sing. The voice really couldn't do anything else. What was it like for you to combine your voice with his on those songs?
Well, I have lyric soprano training before I attempted rock and roll. So there was a lot of timbre melding there. I mean, I think our voices, Roger, I guess you agree, blended very well. And we did a lot of backing, too. It was also Elizabeth Lammers and our good friend Danny Brooks. I don't know if you're going to talk to Danny or not, but he's another wealth of information. But John's voice, it was just amazing to me how well he sang for so long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the man could remember lyrics. I have to write lyrics on my hands, and, you know, I have to have a script on a monitor. He just knew lyric after lyric. He had an incredible memory. I mean, yeah. he could go for 2 hours and not even take a break. And, you know, if his voice cracked, he'd just go on, didn't matter, and mm-hmm. he'd recover and acknowledge his, you know, humanity and go on. And the audience loved that about him. They just loved that he was, you know, fallible, but yet in the way, he really was a great entertainer. And his voice was true tenor. I mean, absolutely true tenor. It was interesting when he did the duet with Pavarotti, who was that very trained tenor, and then John didn't go the opera route, but still
Placido
somehow...
Domingo.
I mean, Placido, I'm sorry. But still, we did the show at the in Hollywood, right? At the he did the duet with him?
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah. And we did that with him, and it was... They worked together well, and there you have two different types of tenors.
Yes.
And it worked very well because his voice was... There wasn't anything edgy about it. It was just a very pure tone.
And he wasn't classically trained or took a bunch of lessons, did he? It was all natural?
Well, you know, he knew all about voice training. I mean, mm-hmm. before every show, he'd be doing the back. Yeah, he was vocally trained, and he treated it like a muscle. I mean, he really took care of himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just had an incredible instrument, but he worked it to the max.
We're spending time with Connie Reeder and Roger Nichols, very good friends of John, of course, both professionally and personally. And I've asked everybody this question that I don't know why. I mean, I know where I was at when I heard about John's accident. And I over the years, I guess I'm not saying accident anymore, I'm saying incident, because I still have this overwhelming sense from the people that I've talked to that, as you just alluded to, Connie, still around in just a different way. And if we, I think I said this before we even started, that if, you know, 10 years goes by and people are still talking about me this way after I'm gone, then I've done a pretty good job. But where were you two? What do you remember about 10 years ago?
Well, actually, I helped John pick out his plane, and long easy that he yeah. crashed in. And so John, I said, you know, whenever you get it finished at the paint place, and you know, I'll fly to Santa Maria and meet you, and when you pick up the plane. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay. So Friday, he called me up and said, hey, Raj, and I'm going to go pick up my plane at Santa Maria. And I said, well, tomorrow, Saturday, right? And I said, well, I can't meet you Saturday. I have to go to Nashville to do something with Bela Fleck, but then I'll fly from Nashville to Monterey Sunday morning. And he said, okay, great. I'll see you there. And what's funny is at that same time he called...
We crashed on Sunday.
Connie was... Yeah, I know. Yeah. Connie and I were doing some harmony vocals on one of John's songs. Working on, you know, taking some stuff that had been used in Denmark or something, and mm-hmm. then, you know, polishing it up to release in the United States. So I went to Nashville, worked with Bela Fleck, and then Sunday morning I was driving to the airport, and I heard on the radio that somebody had stolen John's plane and crashed it. So I immediately called Ron, and I said, what's going on? And he said it was John. Mm. And so that's when I found out that that John had crashed, and I immediately called Connie. I don't know whether she heard it
No,
before.
That's how I found out. He called me sobbing, and that's how I found out.
What do you
think? I just talked to John the night before. You know, it's so interesting. Like, you go back over things when something like this happens, and the last, he called the night before. You know, it's the everyday stuff, you know. I mean, he called, he wanted to know about a guitar, some guitar he wanted that was in Chicago. Do you remember that, Roger?
Yeah.
And that's the last thing, you know, that's the last thing we talked about, a guitar. But that's probably cool, because, you know, my old guitar.
Right? It's been nothing short of just an amazing gift to have you both today.
Thanks, Todd. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you for the gift of you.
As I sat thinking about putting this special together to really celebrate the life of John Denver, I started thinking about all the friends that he worked with over the years, the people that he spent time with, the people that he wrote songs with, the people that he toured with. And if you go back to the early 1970s, I can remember sitting in front of the television set and watching John sing on television, and Jim Croce and Gordon Lightfoot. But there was another guy who really caught my attention way back when. The song Wildfire has become really an American West anthem. And Michael Martin Murphy is the writer of that song, of course, the singer of that song, a very well-respected singer, songwriter, pop and country Western music. And some people credit Murph for the whole cowboy music movement, and I'm not here to disagree with that for sure. I think one of the best songs that Michael Martin Murphy ever wrote and that John Denver ever recorded and I've ever heard in concert was an incredible composition called Boy from the Country. He actually pulled his touring caravan over in Texas just to join us today, and Michael Murphy talks about John Denver. Hey, Murph.
How you doing today, partner?
If you go back, you and John, of course, longtime friends and boyfriend of the country, which I believe you wrote about St. Francis of Assisi. Isn't that true?
Yes. My brother gave me this book, and I think you really like this book. It's a remarkable story. It's about how St. Francis left behind wealth and fame and talent and took on a vow of poverty. But as he went around, he saw God in nature. I used to sing that song a lot, and I recorded it on my first album. Steve Weisberg, who was from Dallas, Texas, which is my hometown, became his guitar player. Steve calls me up one day, and he said, you know, Murph, I played Boy from the Country, which I guess Steve had heard me play in many nightclubs, coffee houses over the years, because I was kind of a folky who played more in coffee houses than nightclubs. And he said, I played the song for John Denver, and John really likes it. And I think he's going to record it. So sure enough, he did. Then he recorded it again. Denver recorded it again on a live album where he did a world tour. After Steve moved to Aspen, he had already been playing with him for a while. He said, Murph, I want you to come up here and meet John. So he introduced me. So the first time I met John was in the context of him playing a concert at Red Rocks.
Wow.
And he took the time to say, thanks for writing the song. I really like the song. I have an affinity for that song, and I'm going to keep on singing it. And then we became friends. I was living in Colorado at that time, and it wasn't that far to Aspen from where I lived, and I used to go up and go skiing with John. Ultimately, I asked him to record with me. So that's how I first got to know him. Ironically enough, I think Boy from the Country ended up describing John's life too. Ironically, it looks to me like Boy from the Country was almost a prediction.
Yes, it was.
Of how his life would go. I want to share my greatest memory of John Denver. I asked him to come over to Caribou Ranch in Colorado to record on Swans Against the Sun, as you mentioned. What I remember is that John flew over from Aspen. I met him at a little private airport in Boulder and drove him up to the sessions. He stayed for a couple of days. Then I drove him back down to this little private airport. He got back in a single engine plane by himself and took off, flew over the Rockies. And my memory that's forever seared in my mind is that there was a thunderstorm coming over the Rockies, and between the ridge of the Rockies, probably at 14,000 feet at that place where he flew through, and the squall line of the thunderstorm, there was a little gap of blue sky mm-hmm. and the sun shining through. And I remember forever John's little plane going through that little blue gap in the sky. And I remember calling Annie to see if he got there okay. Because I was so scared to see him flying into that thunderstorm. But that was John. The press loved to make him look like he was some wimpy little guy with glasses. Let me tell you, he was as strong of a man as John Wayne and just as committed to adventure as John Wayne ever was. A hell of an athlete and a good man and a guy who really stood up for nature and the environment, inspired an awful lot of other people to get into that. I know nobody can picture this, but, you know, let me tell you what John Soule was. He was the adventurous bush pilot with the eye patch. I'll never forget the man. Amazing guy. He discovered a lot of people and helped a lot of people. I would have starved to death at the time he recorded Boy from the Country. I would have probably starved to death if I hadn't gotten that cut on his album.
Well, Murph, I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to share with us on your thoughts about John and his music and your friendship. And I wish you safe travels and long sunsets.
Well, God bless John Denver, and God bless you for putting this together. And long may his memory live, but more important, long may his message live.
Because he called. Because he called the earth his mother. They drove him out into the rain. Some people said the boy from the country was insane. Because he spoke to fish in the creek. He tried to tell us that the animals can speak. And who knows? Perhaps they do. I know they do. How do you know they don't? Just because they've never spoken. His home when he was young. Boy from the country. He loves the sun. Yes, he does. Tried to tell us we should love the land. We just turned our heads and laughed. You see, we did not understand. Sometimes I think from the country is the only one who sees.
see the forest for the trees. Boy from the country left his home when he was young. Boy from the country he loved the sun.
So the original program was a lot longer than that. I've really chopped down a lot of these interviews. People that, like Ron Dutchendorf, John's brother, was in the show. And as I mentioned, Annie Denver, I kind of leaving them out of this one a little bit. You know, this time of the year and is not easy on the family, so I'm just going to respect that. And the people that I talked to, unfortunately, Milt Okun has passed away. Terry Lippman has passed away. Roger Nichols has passed away. And I mentioned in the first part of this that I was teaching high school when I found out that the WinStar Choices for the Future Symposium in 1994 was called The Human Family. And I wanted to finish this podcast with that poem, lyric, whatever you want to call it. I actually gave the words to John and said, this would be a great song. And he looked at him and said, yes, it would. Put him in his hip pocket. And that was the end of that. Little sideliner note here. I've always been amazed, and while I think it's fantastic that people remember the man and the music, I think the message is the thing here. The messenger, not nearly as important as the message, but without the messenger doesn't get delivered. And I think sometimes that gets lost in celebrating the music and not applying, I know, what John thought was the most important thing, which is being a steward of the planet, being aware enough of the surroundings that we're in, that we take care of things and we have a balanced approach for a sustainable future. And it's not an easy road, but you do it anyway, no matter what. And so, have you ever sat in wonder at the setting of the sun or how a flower blossoms and that summer always comes? Have you ever held a snowflake or dried a small child's tears? Have you ever dreamed of peace and love throughout your living years? You're the heart of the human family, the promise of life to come, the pulse of the living world, and you are the only one. Have you ever walked in the rain and smelled the sweetness of drops in the wind? Ever knelt in humble prayer and forgiveness of imagined sin? Ever hurt so bad that you swear you'd really rather die and woke the next morning to see rainbows in the sky? You're the eyes of the human family. You're the promise of life to come, a prophet of faith and giver of dreams. You are the only one. Have you ever seen the hunger in the children of the land and watched as we consume ourselves, destroying what we don't understand? Ever stood in silence as the leaders slowly take their fall, praying for their legacy and all those names on cold stone walls? You're the voice of the human family, the promise of life to come, a singer of songs for all the world, and your greatest has yet to be sung. And on this day, sit and wonder at the miracle that you truly are, and know that your light shines from the heavens within, and it's as bright as the midnight star. And dream your dreams of a world without hunger, where the children never shed cruel tears, and know that you can make that happen by living through untrue fears. We are the human family with footsteps in the sand. We are the human family. We're walking hand in hand. We are the human family. We're responsible for all we see. We are the human family. The truth will set us free. Thanks for listening. Safe travels. Until next time, adios.